Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It is a big week for Republicans in California. Tonight, the major presidential candidates for the GOP face off in the second debate at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley. Then this weekend, many of the candidates will head over to Anaheim for the California Republican Convention. Former president and frontrunner Donald Trump will be skipping tonight's debate, as he did the first, but he is planning on speaking at the convention this weekend. Meantime, Democrats, with the help of Governor Gavin Newsom, will be working hard to blunt the Republican message in the state. The stakes are high as California moved its primary up to March, so we will all be voting sooner. Seema Mehta is a political reporter with the Los Angeles Times and will be covering tonight's debate and this weekend's upcoming GOP convention. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's start with tonight's debate. You were at the Reagan Presidential Library yesterday. What's the scene like?
I mean, it's the debates. I've been to several debates at the library, and I mean, the library is obviously just a beautiful, beautiful setting. And especially the place where the debate takes place, you know, in front of what was Air Force One, you know, because it's only Air Force One when the president's on it. It's really remarkable. But tonight it's going to be really interesting between, you know, several candidates on the stage, a lot of protesters outside, tons of media. It's going to be a scene.
Do you have any idea why California was selected as the second location for a presidential debate for the GOP, given that, well, you know, we have a Democrat supermajority in the state?
We do, but California is actually, I mean, despite the fact that, you know, realistically, California will not matter in the general election, it does matter in the primary. For you mentioned that, you know, we moved our primary up. So the primary is taking place on Super Tuesday, along with, I believe, 14 other states. We have the most delegates of any state in the nation. They'll be going to the Republican National Convention. We have 169. It's a huge donor community. And then also, if you think about like past administrations, I mean, so many members of the Trump administration came from California. People like Stephen Miller. I mean, you know, and there was a ton of people who were very influential. So California, even though it doesn't matter in the general, most likely unless something changes dramatically, it does matter in Republican politics a lot. And that said, also the Reagan Library is just it's been the home. I've been to several debates there, and I know more have been there than I've been to. So it's a thought sort of leader for Republican politics, for Republican politicians. And it's also just a beautiful setting.
Yeah. There will be a good amount of candidates debating tonight. Who will be on the stage?
Most of the major candidates will be on stage. I mean, two of the ones that who did not make it. So there were, you know, there were requirements in terms of how much polling you need, how much, you know, fundraising, you know, measures you had to meet. So Larry Elder will not be on it. Asa Hutchinson will not be on it. But there will be, I think it's seven that will be on the stage. And then former President Trump could be on it, but has chosen not to be on it.
Why is he skipping?
He hasn't said it directly, but there's a couple things going on. But first of all, he's the front runner. And I think his people don't really believe he needs to do it because, I mean, he's doing really well in both state and national polls. And then secondly, he has kind of a beef with some of the people who have led the library or have led the Reagan Institute, Fred Ryan, who is also the publisher of the Washington Post. And he has not been quiet about.
Right. When it comes to those polls that you're mentioning, national and statewide, I mean, we know that former President Trump is the front runner. But when you look into like more details behind those numbers, is it the same in California? Does California reflect the national polling for President Trump?
It doesn't actually. It's interesting to watch. If you look at the polling over, you know, the past 6 months, at one point, Ron DeSantis, you know, the governor of Florida, was leading the former president here. But now he's not doing well at all. And the former president has well over 50% of the support in the polls right now. I mean, you know, there's still a bit of time to go before the primary. But if he maintains that, you know, support of more than 50% based on how the state Republican Party changed its rules in terms of delegate allocation, which is a little bit in the weeds. But he will get like all of the state's 169 delegates, which is 14% of the delegates he needs, you know, to clinch the nomination.
What symbolism can be drawn just from the location of tonight's debate? I mean, it's at the Reagan Presidential Library. In terms of the difference between former President Reagan and Republicans taking the stage tonight.
Right. I mean, I think one of the most interesting things that we will hear tonight is about national security and foreign policy, and, you know, Reagan, you know, peace through strength. His efforts with the USSR and now what's going on with Russia and Ukraine. I think that's, you know, just it's a different Republican Party today than it was, you know, in the 80s. And I think foreign policy is a key part of that, that I think a lot of people are waiting to will be, you know, have an ear out for tonight.
Hmm. What do you think the appetite will be from just the general public who will tune in tonight, given that, you know, the front runner for the Republican Party currently is going to be a no-show?
I think that's a great question. And I don't know the answer to it, but I do think that the fact that the former president didn't participate in the last debate and isn't participating tonight, I do wonder if that takes away from some of the appeal. And I do wonder if he, you know, eventually does, you know, decide to participate in some upcoming debates.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously we're talking about Republicans, but, you know, it's not right. Like Democrats are taking a back seat this week. President Biden does have a plan to counter all of the attention and the sound bites that will come from tonight's debate. I mean, he recruited Governor Newsom to do a lot of the forward facing talking for him. What's planned?
I mean, so President Biden is in the Bay Area. I think he got there yesterday. He's doing fundraisers. He's also doing a public event today. Governor Newsom is all over the place in terms of Silicon Valley and like just doing a bunch of interviews. And he's going to be in the spin room. So he's definitely going to be a vocal presence defending the president's administration and his policies tonight.
Mm. Aside from Newsom, who else is going on the offensive for Democrats?
I mean, the DNC is here. I mean, the whole Team Biden is here. So there's a lot of Democrats here. But also, I mean, I think part of their plan is just to sort of let the Republicans fight it out amongst themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, a little bit of a Rose Garden strategy.
Yeah, so it's just a big week for California politically.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You have a lot of heavy hitters here this week in the Golden State. You know, we're obviously talking about the presidential candidates, and they're going to be, the Republican Party at least, are going to be debating tonight. But when it comes to those down-ballot congressional races that here in California, what do you see bubbling up to the surface?
Oh, there are so many races that can decide control of the House. And it's kind of remarkable because, again, everyone thinks of California as such a blue state. And if you look at it, you know, statewide, it is. It absolutely is. But then there, you know, there are swaths of California that are purple or red. And some of these districts are just so close, so tight. There is so much money that it's, you know, that both parties and their various super PACs, et cetera, have devoted to spending here. So, you know, some in Orange County, some in the Central Valley, one in LA County. I mean, those races are going to decide control of the House. Yeah. They will decide whether Kevin McCarthy will remain Speaker of the House.
Mm. You know, we think about the primary, even though it's been moved up like in March, it seems like next year. But, you know, I would imagine for you being a political reporter, I mean, that is like a blink of an eye. Like it goes by so fast.
And also, I mean, you know, the primary is, yes, it's March, it's Super Tuesday. But, you know, we all get mail ballots now, you know, because of COVID. So realistically, we'll be getting mail ballots in early February. So we will start voting maybe 2 weeks, you know, 2.5 weeks after Iowa and New Hampshire. So it's even closer than you think.
Yeah, just like a day or two after this debate tonight, we're going to have the California Republican Convention this weekend in Anaheim. Former President Trump is expected to be there as well. What happens at these types of conventions, especially with higher stakes, given that it's a presidential election year?
So, I mean, the state Republican Party conventions, they used to draw a lot of presidential candidates back in the day, but recently they've been fairly quiet. So this is actually a little bit of a turnaround. So, as you mentioned, former President Trump speaking at the luncheon, Senator Tim Scott speaking in the afternoon on Friday, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is speaking Friday evening, Vivek, he's speaking on Saturday. So this convention is really, really busy. And it's just, you know, it's about courting delegates, it's about courting donors, which is, you know, I know of several fundraisers for Trump and for DeSantis. I mean, but Trump is having one in Beverly Hills Friday night that costs $100,000 a person, well, for a super PAC. So it's about courting delegates, you know, the most active, you know, members of the state Republican Party. It's about courting the donors who are, you know, paying attention, who will be there. So it's really, I mean, it's going to be quite the active convention. And it's sort of a little bit of a throwback because we haven't seen one quite like this for a little bit of time. The other question is, like, what kind of protests happen? So if you remember back in 2016, when Trump was, you know, first running for president and he spoke at the convention in Burlingame up north in the Bay Area, you know, there was huge protests and he, you know, to the point where he couldn't come in through the normal entrance and they had to bring him through the freeway and have him like walk over this embankment. You know, there's Great video of it. So that's the other question about, what does the protest situation look like on Friday?
When it comes to how the rules have changed in California, when it comes to like, it's kind of like a winner, it is a winner take all now in
As long as you
California.
hit 50%. If you hit 50%, it's winner take all.
Yeah, and you recently reported on this and about how the Trump campaign changed the rules in several states, not only California. Can you kind of like explain, give us the bullet points of what exactly happened and the big differences now?
Sure, absolutely. It's a little in the weeds, but it's actually really important because, it's like a lot of the media coverage will, focuses on the horse race, who's ahead by what. But, how parties, both parties pick their nominees is by delegates. And every state has a different set of rules for picking their delegates. And the Trump campaign in 2016 really did not know what they were doing. And they, which were on the fly. But they learned from that. And they started reworking delegate rules across the country even before the 2020 election. So in California and Nevada and Michigan, I mean, in states across the nation, there's more winner take all, or at least winner take all, if you get that 50, if you hit that 50% benchmark. There was an attempt to move to caucuses in some states. There was an attempt to make the delegates, binding. So if you are a delegate and you have to, vote for who your state voted for, at least for the first or second round. So they really, it's really remarkable how much different and how much more organized they are now compared to how much they were in 2016.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with LA Times political reporter Sima Mehta about tonight's GOP presidential debate, as well as this weekend's Republican convention in California, which will be held in Anaheim. I want to go back to Governor Newsom for a moment, because after lots of rumbling and rumors, it's finally seems official. The governor will be debating Florida Governor Ron DeSantis on Fox in November. Remind us how this all came about.
I mean, the two of them have been sparring for years. I mean, and especially it came to a head during COVID, I feel like, where they were offering two very different, state approaches in terms of how do you do, shutdowns, mask mandates, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, if you remember, I mean, in Governor Newsom's reelect campaign, his first advertisement aired in Florida. It did not air here because he apparently, I think he likes jabbing at some Republican state governors, including Governor DeSantis, as well as young Governor Abbott in Texas. So the two of them have been sort of engaged in this dance for quite some time. I'm kind of interested that this is actually happening because, they've been talking about it, but I wasn't sure if it would actually happen.
Yeah. I'm curious what's in it for Governor Newsom, because, not too long ago, he sat down with Sean Hannity, on Fox as well for a very long conversation. I mean, what's in it for him to do this? I mean, essentially to raise his national profile?
I mean, I think, yeah, and I think he enjoys sparring with people who don't agree with him. And I mean, I remember like when he sat down with Sean Hannity, it was interesting. I remember talking to some Republican sources who are not fans of his, but were sort of impressed by his mastery of, certain facts, et cetera. And if you remember when he wrote his book, it's Citizenville, Newt Gingrich is one of the people who lauded that book. And, obviously those two men don't agree about anything. So he does have a history of this. And I think, it raises his national profile. And if you look at what role he's taking for the Biden campaign, he's been sort of like one of their top attackers. And it seems, so this is another opportunity for that. For Governor DeSantis, I mean, he was once viewed as like, sort of the top alternative to President Trump for the GOP nomination. And then, the polling obviously isn't working out very well for him, and we'll see what happens. I mean, there's still time. But he also, I think, has a lot at stake here.
Yeah. What are the risks involved? I mean, we can see the benefit going on the offense, for Governor Newsom. But what are the risks involved for engaging in this?
I hate to say this, but, this nation is so polarized that if you're a Democrat, you're going to see what you want to see in Newsom. If you're a Republican, you're going to see what you want to see in DeSantis. So, I mean, unless you make a massive error, like, I don't think this changes the narrative in any way. But I think it's a fun media story.
Yeah. I mean, you've done a lot of reporting because so much has been happening in California also, with national implications. I mean, you reported on an effort here in California, as well as other states, to effectively like ban former President Donald Trump from the presidential primary, citing the 14th Amendment. Explain what the effort is here in California and beyond, and where it actually stands. Does it have weight to hold?
I mean, there have been lawsuits filed. So there's one filed in Colorado, one filed in Florida, one filed here, that argues that the former president basically was involved in treason, and that therefore disqualifies him from, you know, from running for president again. The one in Florida was kicked out immediately. The one in Colorado was filed very recently. The one here was filed very recently. I mean, it's a legal argument that honestly legal scholars disagree about. I mean, there are some conservative and liberal legal scholars who have put this forward, but then there's also scholars on both sides of it who don't think that this is going to work. And actually, I mean, I think that there is more, there are more legal scholars on both sides of the aisle who don't believe this is going to go anywhere.
Has Trump said anything in response to these efforts?
I have not heard, Brad, I can't guarantee, but I've not heard him say anything in response.
Seema, thank you so much.
His campaign certainly has. His campaign has basically said this is like totally misguided and like basically a political witch hunt, which they also say about, you know, the various charges he's facing in various different jurisdictions across the country.
Seema, thank you so much. I know it's a very busy week for you.
Sure thing. Thank you for having me on.
Seema Mehta is a political reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Up next, hundreds of bills passed by state lawmakers and are awaiting their fate with Governor Newsom, including a bill that could legalize some psychedelics like psilocybin, which is found in mushrooms. We'll learn about the first accredited university that is based in California, and they're training therapists, doctors, and nurses in the benefits of psychedelics and how to use them safely. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Governor Newsom is currently going through hundreds of bills passed by the state legislature, determining whether to sign each one into law or to veto. One bill would decriminalize some psychedelic drugs, like psilocybin, which is found in magic mushrooms. From Oregon to Colorado and Washington, D.C., laws surrounding the use of psychedelics have been loosened, decriminalized, or even legalized in a supervised setting. And even more conservative states, like Texas and Utah, are moving forward with exploring the therapeutic benefits of psychedelics for disorders and conditions like PTSD, depression, anxiety, as well as addiction. Governor Newsom hasn't indicated whether he will sign this bill into law, which does come with pushback from law enforcement groups who claim decriminalization will lead to more crime and that the lasting health impacts of these drugs is still largely unknown. But California is already home to the first accredited university training therapists, doctors, and nurses in the benefits of psychedelics and how to use them safely. We're going to revisit a conversation I had with Dr. Janice Phelps, the director for the Center of Psychedelic Therapy and Research at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, about its benefits to treat mental health conditions in a supervised setting. Well, let's start with, you know, the elephant in the room. There has long been stigma attached to psychedelics. They are still illegal under federal law as a Schedule I controlled substance, which includes drugs like heroin, but also marijuana, which is legal in a growing number of states in the country. So we're talking about psychedelics in a therapeutic setting versus recreational. How do you want people to think of psychedelics as a form of treatment?
Sure. Maybe we can contextualize this, perhaps, Vicki, with the research that's been done in the last couple decades on the psychedelics, psilocybin, as you mentioned, and MDMA, which is very helpful for PTSD and depression. They've been studied for decades, despite the stigma that you were mentioning. Back in the 90s, the Hefter Research Institute started instituting sponsorship for psilocybin research, and around that time, MAPS, an organization looking at MDMA, began its research. And the research has been rather phenomenal. But as you and your audience know, the misuse of these medicines in the 60s and 70s and the politics that were, fraught around that time made it very difficult for people to have a sober and objective view about the pros and cons of these medicines. So now, with the efficacy being shown to be quite solid, there's more interest. So there's pushback against the stigma. And as a political movement happens around these medicines, there's be conservative pushback back again. Mm-hmm. So we're in a very interesting time, as Confucius would say. There's lots of challenges and opportunities here. And at CIS, we were very bold. Back in 2016, we started training licensed medical professionals and mental health professionals to do this work because we could see this coming. that these substances would be explored more, its effectiveness and safety measures would be explored more. And so it's an exciting time, but it's a new era for these medicines. But Indigenous peoples have been using these medicines for millennia, safely in their villages and small community units for healing the community, for healing one another, for healing individuals. So it's got a wonderful legacy.
When you talk about CIS, you're the director, you lead the Center for Psychedelic Therapies and Research in San Francisco. How did your work in psychedelics as a form of therapy and treatment begin?
Oh, I'm old enough to have been able to explore things and do my own research, if you will, in the 60s. And then with MDMA before it got rescheduled in 1985. So I had it there and felt the benefit of it for myself and my peers when used in a safe way. That's the big concern here is how can it be used safely? So at CIS, we emphasize how to use these medicines safely. These are trained therapists who know how to do talking therapy, and these are medical docs and nurses who know all about the physiology now of psychedelics. So they're going to be excellent practitioners. We're the first accredited university to get approval for this. There are other universities coming in our wake, and we've broken some ground, and I'm really happy to see that other universities are starting programs watching what we're doing. This is Harvard, Yale, Johns Hopkins, NYU, Naropa University in Colorado, Columbia, UPenn Nursing School is starting one up. It's very exciting.
You mentioned that research into psychedelics, I mean, it spans even decades before in the United States with the Controlled Substance Act of 1971, when most psychedelics became illegal under federal law, there was research, you know, that was being looked into in the United States. How has this research evolved since you entered into this field?
Sure. There's lore that as many as 40,000 people were participating in studies from the 50s through the early 70s. It's not well documented, but it's evidence, I think. As a clinical psychologist, I've researched this, and in an article I wrote a few years ago, I summarized it. It's a lot of case studies in the past, and a lot of anecdotal evidence and a lot of exploration in hospitals on how to use these medicines well, particularly mescaline and LSD at the time. And we had the advent of this wonderful organization, Hefter Research Institute, of which I'm a board of trustee, that they got together funding to put together double-blind randomized studies with placebos. That is the gold standard for research in medicine, and developed programs of studying, as you mentioned at the outset of this great interview we're having together here, about addiction and post-traumatic stress disorder and depression and end-of-life anxiety. Cluster headaches are being looked at. Obsessive compulsive disorder, which is purportedly one of our most difficult symptomologies to heal in psychiatry and psychology, that's been demonstrated to have efficacy with these medicines in small studies. These have been funded by donors because of the stigma you mentioned at the beginning. Obviously, the federal government isn't going to fund a whole lot of these studies, but the NIDA is starting to fund. The VA administration is funding studies. So we're seeing a sea change here.
And help us visualize how some psychedelic can actually be a tool and a way to support and help people heal through disorders or trauma. How does that work inside the brain?
Great. Let's talk about psilocybin. It is the psychoactive portion of the molecule that's found in many mushrooms on every continent on this planet. It's everywhere. And we have an endogenous set of neurotransmitters in our brains that are parallel and consistent with the kinds of triggering that happens in the brain with this particular plant. So it's a marriage made in our biology for us to have compatibility with this particular plant. And in fact, all the other plants that Colorado and Oregon and Canada have been approving, or at least for decrim, not criminalized. Mm. So what happens for the person psychologically as this very effective plant comes into their system is they experience an alteration in their state of mind that helps them feel wiser, more in tune with themselves. It also, and this is the safety feature here that's so important for the public to know about, difficult feelings and old thoughts of abuse and terrorizing, even some tortuous memories can come forward. Those need to be held very carefully with the person or people sitting with this person to help them hold it and bring in the healing capacity. And many, many people, particularly in the end of life studies, have been shown to have had one of the most beneficial spiritual experiences with psilocybin of their lifetime, lowering their fear of death, lowering their anxiety of dealing with undone relationships and needing to say goodbye to their dear ones, making amends. And that meaningfulness has been such a gift for people using ibogaine, mescaline, LSD, psilocybin, and MDMA. Although it's not as correlated to a positive outcome for MDMA, MDMA tends to bring people's sense of wellness, compassion for themselves, and willingness and ability to hold that, yes, I did go through all that stress as a first responder or as a veteran in the many fields that I was assigned to and serving in, but I see a big picture now. I can hold it in my heart that, yes, it was difficult. Yes, even I may have done things that I regret, but I feel compassion and shame and guilt start to recede. And we have a whole person standing in front of us, much more so than they were beforehand. You don't get this with an SSRI. You don't get this with Zoloft or Prozac or many of the other drugs we use that are not that effective, and we know it.
And a big difference, too, when compared to prescription pills is you're not just prescribed medication and then you send the patient home and then they go and do it by themselves. These are, and especially in these clinical trials, these are in supervised settings.
Yes, the typical scenario is that you're in a beautiful room with a sofa that has been opened up or a day bed or a very lovely lounge chair with your feet raised up. You've got eye shades on if you're willing, and earphones to listen to beautiful music to help you with your journey. You have two people with you who are remarkably well-trained, ideally, at least in the studies they are. So you're feeling the attention of two people for 6 to 8 hours, and they've worked with you for 3 to 4 hours before that on other days to get you prepped and ready, set your intentions for what you'd like to see happen, how to navigate difficult experiences. And these people know what they're doing. And in the movement forward, we're looking at the possibility of doing this work in groups, but still having a very good ratio of trained facilitators being with the people. This is the Oregon model. And there's several studies that have been very successful at UCSF and elsewhere using groups. And it makes it more affordable. We don't want this just to be for the rich, addicted, OCD, traumatized people. We want this to have be accessible in a safe way. That's why public education on this is really important, Vicki. We're all of us in the field working now to push forward for training and research. We're looking on the side, the right and left, that where there's not enough public education about how to use these medicines safely because of the stigma. It's like needle exchange programs and reproductive support for teenagers. There's pushback about that for years until there was more acceptability. So when you see more public education about psychedelics being done, you'll see that the stigma has started to recede even further.
Yeah. I mean,
that's essential.
Yeah. And when talking about, you know, having those difficult conversations, this bill follows other states like Oregon and Colorado. And, you know, the California District Attorneys Association opposes the bill that is moving its way through the state capitol, claiming that by allowing dangerous hallucinogenic drugs to be legalized before they've been fully understood by the scientific and medical communities, it can cause more harm. What is your response to these concerns? You know, because there's a lot of unfamiliarity and a lot of unknowns when it comes to this.
Yes. Well, I think there's three issues here. One is that the medical research is difficult to unpack if you're not trained as a researcher or a clinician to, you know, read between the lines and figure out what they're saying. So that's a problem. We need to really find a way to speak about the research results in a way that the general public can understand. So that's a problem right there. That can be fixed. The second thing is that the list you gave of the scheduled drugs like heroin, it's very interesting. I have a slide on my PowerPoints that I do at conferences. I just did one at Harvard where I showed that the addictive medicines that are scheduled are few and far between. And the psychedelic research, the psychedelic medicines are listed along with the addictive medicines, and they're not addictive. It's been demonstrated. They're neither addictive psychologically nor physiologically. So they're safer than some of the medicines that have been given billions of dollars of R&D and are out there in the general public, as we can name a few like oxycodone. Apropos, Health Canada and Oregon and Colorado figured out that there's no problem. Well, there's problems in safety, but not with the medicines themselves. They dealt with their departments that were pushing back. I believe in California, we'll see the light and we'll follow in the footsteps of these other states and Canada.
Dr. Phelps, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for having me here. It's been really important and helpful to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Janice Phelps is the director of the Center for Psychedelic Therapy and Research at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, discussing the use of psychedelics to treat mental health conditions. Governor Newsom is currently weighing a bill passed by state lawmakers that would legalize the use of some hallucinogenic substances like psilocybin, which is found in mushrooms. Still ahead, California has a long history with low riding, and it hasn't always been pretty. But the state is coming full circle in embracing lowrider culture, and now you can learn about its history at a new exhibit at the Sacramento History Museum. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California has a long history with lowrider cruising culture, and it hasn't always been pretty. The cruising culture dates back to the 1940s and 50s here in California and in the Sacramento area. Soon after, that's when cruising bans came, and a lot of people, mainly from the Latino community, said the laws and regulations were targeted and discriminatory. Flash forward to today. Cruising bans have now been lifted in cities like Sacramento and Modesto, and the governor has Assembly Bill 436 on his desk right now that would remove all cruising bans statewide should he decide to sign it into law. All of this to say, it appears that California is close to coming full circle with the lowrider cruising community and embracing it. And now you can learn more about the culture, the art, the controversy through a new exhibit at the Sacramento History Museum. Joining us today are Delta Pick Mello, Executive Director at the Sacramento History Museum, and Francine Mata, Chair of the Sacramento Lowrider Commission. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
I love the music that kicked us off.
Yes, that was exciting. Thanks for having us.
Francine, I want to start with you. Before we get into this exhibit at the Sacramento History Museum, I'd love to just get back to the first step, the start of the history of low riding and cruising culture in California, going back in time. How did it start and why?
It started, you know, this exhibit has been amazing because we get to interview and sit down and talk to those that paved the way. This is kind of why we had the exhibit, to honor their work. And I know, seeing articles, it was cruising that started probably in the 30s. You know, a lot of people in the car culture, like, it was the 30s, and we called it cruising. Low riding probably came out in the 80s. And it stemmed from, you know, there's stories of post-war and then coming back, you know, there's people that wanted to start finding a hobby, building their cars, and it's been a form of mental health, you know, to help. And then it, you know, it's written, you know, in LA that it's just kind of like an art form. And I'm seeing, you know, stuff that started in LA, but when we started interviewing, it's the same times around California. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't social media back then, but, you know, and that's how they showed their form of art on the cars. We say that, you know, each car tells a story. It's a moving piece of art. Music, clothing, it was a form of self-expression and pride.
Yeah. And when you mentioned that mental health component, I mean, you're working with your hands. Yes. And many times with mechanics, you're solving problems, mm-hmm. you know, lots of puzzles. Mm-hmm. My husband's a mechanic. But there's a lot of pride that you get when you complete that. And mm-hmm. it's a form of expression, as you say.
Yes. And, you know, even from my own family, hearing my uncle's story, you know, he had his first cruise at 5 years old in the 60s. And then it came on to where they started, you know, it's a family engagement, family showing how to work on cars, mechanics, like I said, art form. And it just brings the community, your yeah. family and community together.
And it wasn't only just having like a tricked out car. I mean, you mentioned the art, but there were also like fundraisers. It helped the community as well, many neighborhoods and communities.
And that stemmed. And if I can elaborate on that real quick, you know, I'm a big numbers research person, and say, in, you know, just for our city, Sacramento, there's over 100 lowrider events that's been going on each year for 30, 40 years. You know, you roll in like at 6 a.m., you're leaving at 6 p.m. You get hundreds, if not thousands, of people of each walk of life, age group, socioeconomic status. That's thousands of community hours that we do and give back and generate money for our city and businesses that we contribute, you know, out of our own pockets every year.
If someone hasn't been to a lowrider event, I mean, you just talked about it spans 12 hours. It's all day. Mm-hmm. So much to take in. Help us visualize what it's like to be part of these events.
You know, for me, seeing, you know, my family, you clean your car the night before, 6 a.m., everyone's getting ready to go. Sometimes if a show starts about 10 or 11, you're rolling in 6, 7, 8. You set up, and it's not even car shows, but, you know, you set up and you make sure your car, you shine it up, wipe it off once you get into the venue, and then bring out your chairs, make sure you have food, you know, and then a lot of people, you know, just talking to people, engaging. During these events, you know, there's people all over the state, if not all over the world, you know, because it's reached different countries now. And you're talking about your car, the stories, and it's just nostalgia, mm-hmm. you know, and that's even for the art exhibit. It brings nostalgia. And but it's really a family tradition, you know, bringing the car out on a Sunday morning, afternoon, getting the family together, pulling out your chair, and, you know, sitting there listening to your music, and everyone gathers. You yeah. know, it's a family tradition.
Which means it goes back generations.
Right.
You know, in the 1950s, when cities started passing cruising ordinances, essentially making it illegal, what did you learn from that time from, you know, either, you know, prior generations and your family and community?
Like in the 80s, you know, I've heard the stories of the police brutality, that ordinance that got repealed here in Sacramento, you know, that was used to pull people over of the way they look. San Francisco had to sue, the San Francisco Lowrider Council had to sue the city because there were in their police training on how to identify a lowrider, you know, targeting and being pulled over. And that was a form of putting, you know, so-called lowriders or people, you know, of color into the system. And so, you know, I'm hearing a lot of those stories, and we've always been, you know, identified as gangbangers, and that's not it. You know, we contribute so much to the community. We don't want to be yes, this is what we were titled as before, but this is not us now. You know, we're a diverse, strong, community-driven community lifestyle.
Right. And that has changed considerably in recent years. You know, yes. When you go back to the 80s, what you just detailed to now, mm-hmm. There is an exhibit at the Sacramento History Museum. Cities like Sacramento and Modesto have repealed and pulled back these ordinances. There's a bill that the governor may sign into law that would make that statewide. How does that feel for you and your family? And, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of nostalgia attached to this, and those memories are also painful as well.
Right. And talking to people that lived through those times. I was 5, 6, 7 years old. I remember seeing my dad get pulled over and, you know, being mistreated. And talking to Delta, it's like how it's grown and just, you know, how we started. I don't want to say our fight, but our cause was, you know, getting data and facts and showing, you know, when did you use this ordinance in the last 5, 10 years? It hasn't been used, but you want to have it there as a way to, you know, get us in the system again or to, and that changes lives. You know, with low riding, even on our commission, we have, you know, a retired deputy legislative lawyer that's a low rider. We have business owners, teachers, you know, you name it. And that's important for people to see, you know.
Okay, Delta, I want to bring you in. Okay, you're the executive director at the Sacramento History Museum. Typically, we might think, you know, home to the gold rush. So what led you down to low riding?
Well, when last we talked, we had just partnered with the Sacramento Women's Commission and brought in the quilts.
Yeah.
And that was the first step to a change in the museum's focus. The museum has long focused on the many communities of Sacramento, but it's been from the early 1800s through 1900s. And it's because of where we are in Old Sacramento, it's reflected there. But, you know, when COVID happened, we shut down for a year and a half, things changed. And museums came upon a reckoning, and that was what kind of diversity and equity and inclusion, accessibility, all of those DEI stuff, how are you doing that in your museum and history museum specifically? So we started down thinking, how can we reflect more of the community and be more relevant to the people who live here today and bring in those stories as well? And Francine came to us and said, we would like to do this. Mm-hmm. And it was an easy decision to make. And we were so honored to be able to be the vessel for this story.
And this is the biggest exhibit yet for your museum. Delta, give us a virtual tour of Boulevard Dreams. What will visitors get to experience?
Well, the interesting thing about La Familia part of low riding is low rider bicycles. And so we have a couple of bicycles on display. And those are kind of, I call it, I don't know if this is appropriate, but the gateway to low riding cars. And so you see these bicycles and you hear the stories about how, especially this one bicycle, how he was going down a path that wasn't good, and his mother redirected him and got him interested, and this changed his life. And so there's a story like that. There's photographs of cars throughout iconic places in Sacramento, and they're just gorgeous. There's a whole wall of memorabilia. This is all on the ground floor of lowriders, but also the Latino culture. There's brown berets and other types of visual. Then you walk upstairs and you learn a little bit more about the clubs and, of course, the ordinance and how the Lowrider Commission was formed and its early work as a grassroots organization to repeal this ban. And that takes you through. And there's just beautiful things to see. There's a tribute, there's albums, music, club clothing, just all kinds of, it's vivid and bright and colorful and joyous.
What has the response been so far? Because it's been open for about a week now, right? Yes. What has stood out to you about the response that you're getting from visitors?
The response is that we're getting people that have not come to this museum before. and didn't feel they had a reason to come to this museum. And so we are seeing people. I've walked through the exhibit a couple of times in the last few days, and seeing people that are pointing to the pictures and recognizing people and or talking about their family history or their connection. And that's what we want. We want them to see this and start conversations with each other. So we have seen a great response to it over the weekend. It has only been less than a week. Yeah. So, seeing people that really, they haven't come to mm-hmm. the museum before, and this is their first time, and they're seeing something new and something that's relevant to them.
Francine, you approached this idea, or you brought this idea to the Sacramento History Museum. They were in love with it. They went with it. This past weekend, when you took it in, how did it feel?
It was emotional, seeing someone that looks like you or yourself on up there. And, you know, that's something that I like to kind of be behind the scenes, but I want, you know, those to know that have paved the way and that are still living this lifestyle. It's a family thing that, you know, I'm proud of you. We're proud of you. Thank you for all you've done. Thank you for what you're doing currently. And to recognize that, you know, that it's so much good. Like I said, we've given back so much and endured so much. And so, seeing people smile, seeing people cry. Mm-hmm. Now everyone's like, you know, with the stories, and we need it. And it shows we need our own museum, you know, I mean, because California, we're doing California next month at the California Museum to honor California low riding. But it was amazing because Delta and her staff's been amazing. Our sponsors, you know, Soul Collective helped us, AARP, there's so many people that are now trying to come, and it's just a sense of pride, happiness, and like, wow, we are here. It came full circle.
Yeah. You mentioned the California Museum, and that's a statewide look, but yes. You are with the Sacramento Lowrider Commission. It must feel so special that it's a really narrow lens on what low riding is to Sacramento. I mean, as Delta mentioned, people can go to the exhibit and actually recognize people in these photos. Like, I'm sure you can do that as well.
It's exciting. And just for Delta, you know, Delta's a fresh air. She's like, yes, we need to tell all stories here. This is Sacramento. This is our home, and everyone counts, you know. And I really want to thank Delta for being that way. She's a breath of fresh air. You know, she's just a beautiful person, and that shows in the work and the welcoming.
Yeah. So this exhibit is going to be running until January of 2024. So people have plenty of time to take it in. If someone is unfamiliar with the low riding community and culture and they go, how do you want them to leave after they take in Boulevard Dreams, Francine?
They'll see that, you know, it started, our work started with being closed out of Miller Park, and it tells a story. It shows those that have paved the way and worked and with community working together to tell our story that, you know, we shot for the stars. We repealed our ordinance. Newsom, I, you know, encourage you to please sign that AB 436. And it shows a community and lifestyle coming full circle, you know, that we're here and, you know, all the history and depth we have in California.
And it's a community that doesn't just include men. There are women.
Yes.
There are of all ages. There are children, teenagers, that you'll see pictures and of families. Mm-hmm. This is a family affair.
Delta and Francine, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
I'm excited to go visit it. Delta Picmelo is the executive director of the Sacramento History Museum, and Francine Mata is the chair of the Sacramento Lowrider Commission. You can take in Boulevard Dreams until January of 2024. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.